It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll dig a little deeper into some of the overlooked items in Governor Scott Walker's budget proposal.
First, it might feel a little like 2011 at the state capitol today as unions gather to protest a fast-tracked bill that would make it harder for some of them to exist in Wisconsin. But the private sector right-to-work bill being discussed today is different than Act 10. As Sean Johnson reports, Governor Scott Walker spent years saying right-to-work would not happen under his watch before eventually saying he would sign it.
In Walker's 2012 recall campaign, right-to-work was suddenly a very hot topic. Democrats wanted to make the case that Act 10 was just the tip of the iceberg for the governor and that Walker would go after private sector unions next. Walker never promised to veto right-to-work, but speaking to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel in April of 2012, the governor made it clear that Act 10 was about public sector unions, and he would not pursue a right-to-work bill that banned mandatory union dues at private sector businesses.
From our standpoint, it's never going to get to me. I mean, the reality is, we've talked about this before, private sector unions are my partner in economic development.
In May of 2012, the issue boiled up in a big way after a documentary surfaced showing a major Walker donor asking the governor about right to work and Walker doing little to dissuade her. When reporters asked about it at the state GOP convention, Walker was much more forceful.
It's not going to get to my desk. I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure it isn't there.
2 years later, in his reelection campaign, right to work emerged as an issue in some Republican legislative primaries. Unions said that if Walker and Republicans won in November, it would absolutely lead to right to work in Wisconsin. When Walker was asked to react to that statement in September of 2014, he said,
"Absolutely wrong. Couldn't be more inaccurate. That's the kind of scare factor and distortions that they tried to put out before."
Even after the election, Walker said right to work would be a distraction from his agenda. But once Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald announced that the Senate would pass a right to work bill, it took Walker just a few hours to announce that he would sign it. It's a far different approach than Walker took with Act 10. But this has all played out before, not in Wisconsin necessarily, but in Michigan with Republican Governor Rick Snyder.
My perspective is, as I've made it clear, it's not on my agenda. Right to work is an issue that's a very divisive issue.
Snyder, like Walker, said repeatedly that right to work was not on his agenda. But when Michigan's Republican legislative leaders made it clear that they would pursue right to work, Snyder changed his tone.
When it arrives on my desk, I plan on signing it. We've had a lot of good discussions on this topic, healthy discussions, and I think this is what's best for Michigan.
Michigan Public Radio's Rick Pluta covered that debate and the protests it spawned. A lot of what Pluta describes sounds like it could have happened in Wisconsin in the run-up to Act 10, a big, impassioned, loud, sustained demonstration where protesters filled the Capitol's rotunda, its hallways, and its lawn. But Wisconsin's protest stayed largely peaceful. Michigan's right-to-work protest did not.
There were times when pepper spray was used to try and push back the protesters. In one particular case, a pro-right-to-work group, Americans for Prosperity, hired a hot dog vendor, and they set up a tent in the middle of the Capitol lawn, and the tent was torn down, and the vendor's hot dog cart was destroyed.
Despite the energy and the anger, Pluta says Michigan Republicans did not pay a political price over right-to-work, probably because these days most people don't belong to a union. That's even more true in Wisconsin, where union membership took a substantial hit after the last labor battle 4 years ago. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
While right-to-work has been dominating the headlines since news broke last Friday, the state budget has been the other big story in Wisconsin government. We've been seeing a lot of stories about potential cuts to the University of Wisconsin system, changes at the DNR, and education reform. But some of the major changes outlined in the proposal have gotten lost in the shuffle.
Here to dig a little deeper into the budget proposal is Jason Stein. He's a Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Jason, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. Good to be here.
So Governor Walker's budget proposal, over 1,800 pages long, what made some of the parts of this budget get right out into public consciousness and others maybe stay below the radar?
Well, Rob, there's always,
you know, the big ticket items, the items that affect the most people in the state, that are the biggest dollar items, you know, and sometimes just things that are, for whatever reason, sexier to the public or to the media than others. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot happening right now. We've got a governor who's a real 2016 contender. We've got protests today at the Capitol over right to work. And then we've got, you know, major proposals like a $300 million cut to the state university system. So amid all that, it's not surprising to me that a lot of these details on other major things just still haven't gotten attention.
And looking at the document itself, it seems like it takes a while to digest what's going on. I opened up the document today. It didn't crash my computer, even though it's 1,800 pages. And a lot of it is, you know, three or four words and then colon and then two pages of ordinance numbers that it changes or code numbers that
Absolutely.
It changes. So
is
it just hard to figure out what page whatever does sometimes?
Sure. I mean, and I've covered five of these budgets over the years, over the past decade, and there's a order in that things always happen, Rob. And the way it works is you've got the governor puts forward his budget proposal, whoever the governor is, and, you know, for the first day and even to a certain extent for weeks afterward, a lot of the public is relying on the governor's presentation of his budget or her budget to sort of understand what's in this big 1,800-page document that is written, as you point out, in this sort of legalese, right? That the plain English summaries of what the bill are doing right now are only available from the administration. You know, within a matter of days, we're going to start receiving from the legislature's nonpartisan budget office. We're going to receive their plain English summary of everything that's in this 1,800-page budget. And then you will start seeing, you know, more news stories, more public comment about these other items that right now the administration may not be highlighting, but we may, you know, the public may see as important in the coming days.
Well, in your new piece that you co-wrote with Patrick Marley, you got into some of those issues. I want to cover some of them. One of the changes that hasn't gotten as much attention, phasing out a property insurance program to local governments around the state that I gather the state provides. What would change here and who would it affect?
Well, it could affect all kinds of people around the state. I mean, the city of Milwaukee uses it, Milwaukee County, some of the outlying suburbs around Milwaukee, a number of local governments all around the state make use of programs like that, and even some entities that you might not suspect, like, for instance, you know, the Green Bay Packers, their Lambeau Field Stadium District goes through the city of Green Bay to obtain its property insurance. And so, you know, this state program is available to cities like Green Bay as an option for, you know, again, insuring everything from their local government buildings to even, you know, Lambeau Field as a possibility. So, I mean, it can actually affect, you know, pieces of property and governments all around Wisconsin. I mean, it's definitely not sexy, but, I mean, it's something that if you're a mayor, if you're a city council, that sort of thing may really matter to you.
We're talking to Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Jason Stein about some of the proposals in Governor Walker's state budget that haven't gotten the headlines yet.
And you can call in. What do you think about some of the proposals, maybe the phasing out of that property insurance program or the incentive to state employees who opt out of state insurance or overhauling the state's family care program? What issues do you think need more attention in this budget? We're picking up our discussion about some of the lesser-known items in Governor Walker's budget proposal with Jason Stein. He's a Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
And you can join the conversation with your thoughts and questions. What issues in this budget proposal matter most to you? Are there things that aren't in the headlines that you have been worried about, concerned about, or are glad are changing? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Jason, one that has gotten some attention in the media, a proposal in the budget to give a $2,000 incentive for state employees to opt out of the state health insurance. How would this affect the state's bottom line?
Well, that's a great question, and I wish I knew exactly. The idea is that you would try and get enough people to opt out of the state's health insurance, which by the way costs, you know, quite a bit more than $2,000 a year. That in that way you would save money. I mean, these would be people that might go on their spouse's plan, or, you know, I guess in perhaps limited circumstances, perhaps on a parent or other family member's coverage. But, you know, the question is, already you have a certain number of people that are opting out already, right? And so going forward, then you would be paying each of these people $2,000 a piece to do what they're doing already. And so the question is, are you going to save enough money to make up for the millions of dollars that you're going to be paying people who are already opting out right now? So, you know, right now the state had a consultant study it. I believe the figures were that it would do some between save the state $4 million and cost the state $4 million and save $18 million, but that's a pretty big range, obviously.
And then another issue you write about, the state's family care program. This would be overhauled in this 1,800-page budget proposal. What is the family care program as it currently exists anyway?
Yeah, that's a really important proposal, and you're going to hear more about that one. Family care is a proposal, or a program rather, that provides long-term care to people, the elderly and disabled, who can't care for themselves without some help. And it does that outside of nursing homes. So the idea is to keep people in their homes, in group homes, places like that, right, outside of nursing homes, which tend to be expensive and are places where a lot of us don't really want to live. This proposal would, in a very fundamental way, overhaul family care. And, you know, there could be impacts in terms of people that are in the program right now might have to change their primary care doctor. They might have to change the person who comes into their home to maybe help them wash or do meals or do other essential day-to-day activities. Or, you know, they might even have to change, in the case of disabled folks who live in a group home, they might even have to change where they live. So, I mean, these are all unanswered questions that we have right now, and that we're, you know, going to be seeking answers to those in the coming months.
And is this one of those issues where you expect to see pushback from people with disabilities, from organizations that advocate for them?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you're already seeing that. That, you know, you're not hearing about it because people like me are, you know, tied up. I was tied up all day today, you know, covering a right to work proposal. And, you know, I'm also keeping busy, as you know, many of your WPR colleagues are, covering the governor's potential presidential campaign. So, you know, this pushback is already occurring to a certain extent, you know, and there's also just a lot of questions being asked, and you're going to hear more about it in the coming weeks.
Now, you asked for this piece we've been talking about some legislative leaders for their thoughts on some of these issues. Are they there yet on a lot of the things we've been talking about?
No. I mean, in terms of getting their arms around it, no, absolutely not. Because, I mean, I think most lawmakers in Wisconsin and certainly, you know, the leadership, both Republican and Democrat, they really put a lot of faith in the Legislative Fiscal Bureau. So until they hear from those analysts, you know, and get their take on what the budget bill does, they're not going to necessarily sign on to all kinds of different provisions in it, for one. And two, you know, again, little did I know when I talked to the Republican leaders for that story, I think it was on Thursday, I talked to them, you know, I was catching them as they were walking between meetings on right-to-work legislation. So, you know, some of these other, which was then announced on Friday, that proposal. So, you know, some of these these other second-tier items were probably not front and center in their minds late last week, and they obviously they still aren't.
Well, Jason, thanks so much for joining us again.
It's my pleasure, Rob. Thanks.
That's Jason Stein. He's a Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He was here to break down some of the lesser-known items. It's a long budget proposal. He's telling us about a few of the things that haven't made headlines, at least not yet.
This week, it's the 2015 Greater Milwaukee Auto Show.
Despite lower gasoline prices this winter, makers of electric cars and other alternatively fueled vehicles keep chugging forward. Some say concerns about climate change will be the road to better sales success. Chuck Kornbach reports.
To be clear, the great majority of cars and pickup trucks sold in the U.S. are still powered by traditional gasoline engines. At the Milwaukee Auto Show this week, there are plenty of relative gas guzzlers, including the huge pickups being hawked by a salesperson for Ford.
So this is our strongest, most rigid frame ever for that Ford F-150.
John Meyer of Waukesha checked out one of the bigger trucks that has a front and back seat.
I'm only 29 years old. Probably the next couple of years I'll have kids or whatnot, so we need a bigger car just to haul people.
Meyer says he's not looking at electric or hybrid gas electric cars at the show because he doesn't think the battery technology has come along far enough. That's not the message over at Chevy's electric vehicle, the Volt. Chevy product specialist Sean Bennett steps into the Volt, points at the dashboard, and talks up the technology.
So pretty much everything in front of you will tell you how you're driving, exactly what your range is left as far as your battery life, and how to actually improve it.
The Volt goes about 38 miles on a battery charge before a gas engine needs to take over to allow drivers to go as much as 380 miles. The U.S.-made car interests Michael McNett of Genesee Depot, who says he's thinking about giving up his foreign-made gas-electric hybrid.
I think the fuel savings is a big part of it, but the other thing is I really like to buy domestic if I can. I want to support the American economy, and I'm always torn about buying foreign cars.
But McNett says because of the distance he drives to work, he may want to wait until Chevy's promised upgrade of the Volt that aims to allow a 50-mile battery range, as well as add a fifth seat and possibly cut the price. Some other backers of alternative-fueled cars, like Kyle Gum of Racine, aren't happy with the styling of the Volt, but Gum says he's still hoping electric car makers will suit his taste at a price he can afford.
We want a vehicle that will get us where we want to go with minimal, I guess, abuse, you could say, to the environment.
Tesla, Nissan, BMW, and other car makers have all electric vehicles, and Chevy is promising to get there in a couple years with a model called the Bolt. Jim Tolkien of the Auto Dealers Association of Metro Milwaukee says adding range and more charging stations will be keys to the success of electric cars, but Tolkien says the vehicles aren't going away because of pressure to reduce gas engine emissions that lead to climate change.
Unless you believe that there's no such thing as global warming, and we know 99% of the scientists around the world concur that man's contribution to global warming is very real.
Since much of the electricity for recharging electric vehicles comes from coal or natural gas-fired power plants, there are still concerns about carbon emissions. So Toyota, which has been a leader in gas-electric hybrids but has stopped producing electric cars, is offering one more possibility. Company product specialist Maggie Clark says Toyota's hydrogen fuel cell model, the Mirai, is just waiting on more hydrogen fueling stations.
The state of California is building over 100 stations, and there are many other states that are getting on board.
Now, there's also been some improvement in mileage among the traditional gasoline-fired fleet, though at the Milwaukee Auto Show, you can still find a Maserati that gets just 18 mpg combined city highway and costs $92,000. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Here to look at how the auto industry is doing is Micheline Maynard. She's the director of the Reynolds National Center for Business Journalism at Arizona State University. She also blogs at Forbes.com. Mickey, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much, Veronica.
Well, experts say that the economy has bounced back from the Great Recession. How has this recovery been reflected in car sales?
Well, car sales have bounced back as well. They're actually expected to be as strong this year as they were before the recession. There are some people predicting that we might even see record car sales numbers in 2015, and I think a lot depends on what happens to the price of fuel and also the availability of credit.
When we talk about car sales, we're talking about new cars, right?
Yes, new cars and trucks.
And what's the trend on what sorts of things are selling?
Well, pickup trucks. This has been a really boom time for pickup trucks. One of the reasons is that Chevrolet came out with a new version of the Silverado last year, and the pickup trucks from Ford and Chrysler have recently been updated. And so pickup truck buyers only buy new vehicles every 7 or 8 years or so. And so when there is a new pickup, there does tend to be a bump in sales.
What about the lower gas prices? Has that affected the sales of pickup trucks or other cars, for that matter?
Absolutely. So with lower gasoline prices, you definitely see more people interested in big vehicles, which actually fell out of favor a little bit right after the recession and when gas prices were up in the $3, $4 range. One of the things that Chevy has been promoting is the better fuel economy on its big pickup truck. And it gets about 25 miles to the gallon, which might not be as much as something like a Toyota Prius, but for a big pickup truck, that's pretty good gas mileage.
So is the feeling from consumers that they do want these bigger cars, they just want better mileage?
Well, let's look at the car market for a second, because one of the things to remember about the car market is that only about 10% to 11% of working adults are buying cars in any single year, new cars. And then a big portion of Americans buy used cars. So basically for every one new car that's sold, two used cars are sold. So in the new car market, people definitely are interested in big vehicles again.
Looking at hybrid technology, now this is something that's not brand new anymore. Toyota has been selling the Prius for 15 years now. But what about all electric cars?
So all electric cars are a little bit of a tougher sell. One of the most famous ones is obviously the Tesla. And Tesla comes, the most familiar one that people might have heard of is called the Model S. It costs $70,000. But they're coming out with a new SUV like Tesla, an all-electric sort of a mid-size people carrier, I guess you could call it, sometime this year. Everybody's been waiting for that. And then later in the decade, they're supposed to come out with a small Tesla that's supposed to be much more economical for the average person. And that's the vehicle that people are really keeping an eye on.
And in terms of other new technology, what else will we be seeing coming down the pike in the latest car models?
So everybody is interested in this whole idea of driverless cars, or essentially you could call them assisted technology, because I don't think we're going to be seeing cars running around with nobody behind the wheel. But there's a lot of new features, collision avoidance features, and things that are meant to make it a little easier for drivers to avoid collisions and avoid getting in trouble. And a lot of the analysts think that these new techniques will be helpful in keeping baby boomers and their elders in cars longer. And that's really important because baby boomers are still the biggest car buying group.
And this Apple driverless car, you're saying not so fast on that, but is it something that is going to keep being developed, and maybe one day there'll be, you know, people out there in these Apple or driverless cars?
Right. People are already nicknaming it the iCar. And so everyone in the auto industry is very interested in the possibility that Apple, as well as Google and as well as Tesla, might be getting into the car market. And that's very interesting because for many years it was thought that, you know, the big car companies were just too big to battle. And now what we're seeing, at least with Tesla, is that you can start a new car company and do something different. So that's why everyone is so interested in what Apple might be doing.
Mickey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Veronica. And I hear that new T-shirt is really great.
It is. We were just feeling the fabric.
I hope people will support Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you so very much. Appreciate
that. Take care. Bye-bye.
We've been speaking with Micheline Maynard, director of the Reynolds National Center for Business Journalism at Arizona State University. She also blogs at Forbes.com.